All right, it is late. We're late. It's like 10:01. I'm gonna be in a bad way if I don't start talking. Thank you all for coming. It is Sunday, January the 6th, 2013 at 10:02 a.m. And we are here at Forum Sunday School. And I am so thrilled that you all give me the opportunity to study this information and to relate it to you. It is a great honor to teach some of the most important information of the Western tradition. Now, just so that you all remember what we are doing in this cycle, is we are studying Plutarch's lives, parallel lives. Plutarch was a Greek who was born in 46 AD and died in 120 AD, and his most famous work is The Parallel Lives of Greeks and Romans. He has 23 pairs of lives, which means 46 lives that he actually talks about in parallel, and there are four single lives which are not parallel. And we have, last time we began this study, and we started with Pericles. And today we are going to talk about the parallel Roman life, who is Fabius Maximus. Just so that you all know, next month what I'd like to do is the parallel lives of Alcibiades and Coriolanus. We'll do Alcibiades first, who is like the playboy of ancient Athens and a fascinating figure and the subject of one of Plato's, or more than one of Plato's, dialogues. Alcibiades is a very interesting person who we have studied in various contexts before, so I'm looking forward to doing him. And then the parallel life, which we will do the following month, the Roman life, is Coriolanus, who we know from Shakespeare, and Coriolanus is a recently released movie within the last 5 years, and it's fascinating because it tracks Plutarch's life almost totally. I mean, I saw the movie, and then I went back and did read the Coriolanus life because I was interested in Coriolanus in particular, and I was fascinated by how literally the dialogue from Shakespeare comes straight out of Plutarch. So, you know, the importance of this information, people used to study this all the time. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, everybody would have read all of the parallel lives. And so this is very interesting, exciting, and it's the basis, some portion of the Western tradition. Now, let me tell you what I intend to do today in the short time I have with you. The first thing I want to do, there's three things in structure that I want to do. First, I want to talk about the history of the Roman Empire, both mythologically and the Roman Republic, not the Empire, and actual history. The second thing I want to do is actually go over Plutarch's discussion of Fabius Maximus. And the final thing I want to do is a surprise. I want to connect Fabius Maximus with an important thing in our in the 20th century and even into today. I think you'll be excited by the connection. So first, let me talk about the mythological and actual history of Rome. You know, I don't really believe in fate, but if I believed in fate, I would say I am living fate now, because yesterday Susan and Sally and I went to Les Troyens, which is a Berlioz opera that lasts for 5 hours. It's a very long opera, and it's broken into two parts. The first half is the end of the Trojan War, and the second half is the escape of Aeneas from the Trojan War on his mission from God, from the gods, to found the Roman Republic. And it's based upon the book by Virgil, Aeneas, or the Aeneid, which was written in the reign of the first Roman emperor, Caesar Augustus. And it was sort of a command performance. He was trying to do something for Augustus. And what this is, the Aeneid is a foundation myth. It provides the explanation for the founding of Rome. And the thing that's all about fate for us, for Sally, me, and Susan, is that the last words we heard together yesterday, or the last word, was Hannibal. Because what happens is Aeneas goes to first to Carthage, which is the head of the sort of a Phoenician. It's a Phoenician city that was in great competition with Rome for centuries. And
it was all over trade.
All over trade. And Aeneas meets the queen there, whose name is
Dido,
and they fall in love. And but Aeneas has this mission from God. He's got to go found Rome. And so he leaves Dido, the queen of Carthage, and she is really very angry about that, commits suicides, and puts a curse on Aeneas and his country to come. And then as she's dying, she realizes that Rome will be immortal, because after all, this is a story written by Virgil for the Roman Empire. And so this is an explanatory thing. Why is Carthage constantly at war with Rome? And it's because Dido was cheated. Well, Dido was left behind. And so she said, our avenger will one day come, and that avenger is Hannibal. And of course, my subject today is Fabius Maximus, but his counterpart and the reason for that we're interested in him is because of his struggles with Hannibal. So mythologically, that's where we are. Now historically, the Roman Republic is supposed to have been founded around 753 B.C. By Romulus and Remus, and of course they're probably mythological characters too. And then famously, the Roman Republic was first led by seven great kings, and then we come into the period of the actual Roman Republic. And in that period of the actual Roman Republic, there are three major wars with Carthage, and they are called the First, Second, and Third Punic Wars. And the origin of the word Punic War is from a derivation of the word Phoenician. They are Phoenician wars, but this is sort of a modified version of that war, of that verb. So that is the history. That places us where we're going to be. And that's the first thing I wanted to do with you today. The second thing I want to do is talk more directly about Fabius Maximus. His name was Quintus Fabius Maximus Verrocusus Cuncator. And Verrocusus was a word that just referred to the wart on the top of his lip. And the Cuncator refers to his name, the delayer. He's famous for his delaying actions with Hannibal, and I'll discuss that more in a minute. He came from a famous family. He was and he was elected Council of Rome five times. Now, I know somebody knows what a council is, and so I'm going to ask the audience if anybody knows what that is and wants to tell us in 30 seconds or less. Anybody know what the councils were? The consuls were an elected position. Two people were elected to office to serve as the leaders of Rome for a period of 1 year. This is a wonderful system, and I wish we had something like this these days. And they only served 1 year, and they served alternating months. And they had absolute veto power over one another. So the two consuls had to agree. So Fabius Maximus was elected to this office five different times. He was also elected to the office of dictator twice. Now, we have a very unpleasant connotation for that word, but perhaps it should. It deserves that even in this context. But what happened was that sometimes the Roman people realized that they didn't need to have any ambiguity about what was going on. They didn't have time for veto power of the consuls, and they didn't have time for the approval of the Senate. So sometimes they said, we have to have a dictator whose orders we have to follow without question, and who can put in prison and execute people without question, without approval of the Senate. So this was a really high office. And that office was lasted for a year too. So that's Fabius Maximus's political awards that he got in politics. When he was born, he was thought to be a slow person because he was brave and gentle. He had extraordinary caution. He was docile, and people thought, well, maybe he's just dumb. But Plutarch said he was actually a person of great soul. He had a lion-like temper, and he had unshakable resolution, and that he was just cautious, and this manifested itself in his early life as these traits, which were, and one of his code names meant lamb-like, in fact. But in fact, he was quite the opposite. And when, as a young man, he trained himself for war. His own father had been consul many times, and his ancestors. So he came from a very political and famous family. So he trained himself for war, and he was great at public speaking. One of his speeches, the funeral oration for his son, was actually allegedly preserved, according to Plutarch, although it apparently wasn't preserved unto our time. As I mentioned, he had these five consulships. The life of Fabius Maximus that we're going to study begins, other than the things that I just said about his early life, begins really with the beginning of the Second Punic War. It's not clear whether or not he participated in the First Punic War, but it's obvious that he could have because he was born in 280 and the Second Punic War started at 264 and ran at 241. So he would have been 14 at the beginning of the war and 41, am I doing that right, 39 at the end of the Second Punic War, or First Punic War. So it's very likely that he was a participant, a fighter in the First Punic War, which was actually led by Hannibal's father. Now Hannibal, who we've all heard about, and it's ironic to me that nobody's heard of Fabius Maximus, but Hannibal, who we've all heard about, was a great general from Carthage. And what he did was, and you can't see it on this little map here, but he actually went from Carthage to Spain crossed Spain, the Pyrenees Mountains, southern France, although it wasn't called France at that time, and the Alps, and came into Italy via the Alps. And this was an enormous surprise, an enormous shock. He started in the spring of 218, and what the papers I read said he got there in 218. I just can't imagine going that far by foot, you know, across all that territory in just 6 months, but apparently he succeeded in doing that. And he invaded from the north, and he shocked and horrified the people of the Roman Empire. This was a great, great, this was a great, great scary thing. In fact, down through the Roman history, the stories about Hannibal were used to discipline children. They would say, you be a good little girl, or Hannibal will get you. And of course, we can see how influential Hannibal was, because the entire Aeneid and Virgil's Aeneid is centered around the explanation for why Hannibal was such an enemy of Rome. And, you know, the last words of the Aeneid are Hannibal. And so we can see that even in the early, I don't know when that was written, 15 BC or something like that, even 200 years after Hannibal is long gone, the Romans are still aching over the horror that was Hannibal and is reflected in their literature. So anyway, they come into Tuscany, Lake Trasimene, and Hannibal kills 15,000 Roman soldiers, which is an enormous number. And the existing consul, whose name was Flaminius, was killed also. He was a little bit rash. He went straight into battle with Hannibal, thinking that, well, you know, we've been invaded, our dignity is insulted, and so he went in and fought. Fabius, who had already been consul, was elected in 217. No, he was declared dictator in 217, as you can see here, to deal with this problem. And of course, Rome, the people are traumatized. And so what he wants to do is bring the people out of their trauma and start focusing on, you know, let's get down to business. And so what he does is he makes a big show of himself being the dictator. So he rides on a horse, which is apparently contrary to the rules. I mean, he's supposed to be a member of the infantry, and to be on a horse is sort of a violation of the rules, but it shows that he's taking some serious power. He has his 24 lictors with him, and a lictor was this bodyguard. All magistrates had bodyguards, but the dictator had 24, you know, thugs that would hang around him all the time. And so all his 24 lictors were around him. And there was a surviving consul, as I mentioned, Roman consuls were in pairs. And as I said, in this first war with Hannibal, Flaminius was killed. And so now Fabius Maximus is the dictator and he wants to show his power. And so he says he's in a public situation and the other surviving consul is approaching him and he sends instructions that he is to dismount, that he is to get rid of his lictors, that he is to take off all signets of office and he's to approach him as a common citizen. He said, "I am in charge. Make no mistake about it." The second thing he did to bring people under control, because they're panicked, right? He says, "I'm the boss, don't worry, I'm the man, I'm going to handle this." The next thing he does is he says, "You know, we didn't lose that battle because we're black courage. We lost that battle because we failed to do the religious rites, because we didn't, you know, treat the gods with the proper respect." So he immediately, you know, started this great religious activity to, this is action for the people. Let's do the religious thing and cause, and so this will never happen to us again. And so he proposes a great offering, and that offering, I just want to quickly read it to you. Is something like this. What was discovered in this way could not be made public, but the dictator came before the people and made a vow in their presence to sacrifice to the gods a whole year's increase. That is, all the young produced in the coming spring by the goats, the pigs, the sheep, and the cattle from every mountain, plain, river, and meadow within the bounds of Italy. He also pledged himself to celebrate a musical and dramatic festival and spend on it the sum of 333 sesteria, 333 denarii and a third of a denarius exactly. This sum in Greek money amounts to 83,583 drachma and 2 obols. It is difficult to discover the reason why this precise amount was specified, unless it was perhaps to honor the spiritual power of the number 3. So it makes a big show and pulls people back into order and mentally builds up their confidence. Now, the reason Fabius Maximus is famous is because of his tactics, and here is a description of those. He, Fabius Maximus, was determined not to fight a pitched battle, and since he had the time and the manpower and money on his side, his plan was to exhaust his opponent's strength, which was now at its peak by means of delaying tactics, and gradually to wear down his, Hannibal's, small army and meager resources. With this object in view, he always bivouacked in mountainous country, where he was out of the reach of the enemy's cavalry, and at the same time hung menacingly over the Carthaginian camp. If the enemy stayed still, he did the same. If they moved, he would make a detour, descend a little distance from the heights, and show himself just far enough away to prevent from being forced into action against his will, but near enough to create the suspicion from the very slowness of his movements that he might be about to attack. So he was a very conservative guy, and he's exciting. Now, he was mocked, you know. People want to go into battle. People want to fight. You know, when our people were killed in Benghazi, I was saying, you know, let's send in the troops, let's kill everybody. And I think that's a natural reaction to attacks. And we say, let's kill them all. You know, that's our first reaction. But he was contrary to that. But just like us in America in modern times, people in Rome were not happy with all this. With all this delaying taxes, and he had a sidekick who was the master of the horse, who was in his sort of an officer within his army, and he mocked him and made fun of him and to the German people, I mean to the Roman people, and here's what Fabius had to say about the mocking. In that case, I should be an even greater coward than they say I am. That is a coward because he does this delaying tactic. If I were to abandon the plans I believe to be right because of a few sneers and words of abuse, there is nothing shameful in experiencing fear for your country's sake. But the man who allows himself to be frightened by the opinions of others or their slanders or abuse proves that he is unworthy of such high office as this, since he makes himself the slave of the very men whom in his duty is to restrain and overrule when they go astray and their judgment deserts them. How prudent is that? Isn't that delightful? Don't we just love him for his wisdom in that statement? Now, Hannibal was aware what Fabius was doing, and he was aware of the problems. It's very interesting to read this history and see, you know, Hannibal, you know, has an ear to the Roman public, and he knows that he's getting this backroom criticism, and so Hannibal wants to exploit that. Because of Hannibal's, Fabius Maximus' weakened position, he wanted to do a prisoner exchange with Hannibal. And his deal was trade him one for one. But if we don't have an even number, then we'll have to pay 250 drachmas for each person that's not a traded one for one. So it turned out that that Hannibal had more men than did Fabius Maximus. And there was 240 extra men that Hannibal had. So they had to buy back these men in order to complete the exchange. But because the Senate was disappointed with Hannibal's delaying taxes and wanted to be more aggressive, they would not pay. The Senate would not pay to have the Roman soldiers removed. Their idea was, well, it's because of their courage, their lack of courage, that we're in this problem, and so we're not going to pay. So Fabius Maximus says, okay, sent his son to sell all of his property, sell his estates in Rome, got the 250 drachmas times 240, and paid Hannibal for the men and got them out. And later, when the men would offer, that is the men who were bought out or who were ransomed, offered to pay Fabius back the money that they for his ransom, he said, "No, I forgive the debt." So this, you know, this is another illustration of the character of this man. Now, Fabius was, because of this political turmoil, was asked to come back to Rome to take control of certain religious festivals. He was ordered by the priests to do so, and obviously the dictator wasn't completely at his own will, because the priests told him to come back, and he did. And while he was away, he told his sidekick, the master of the horse, you know, continue my particular practice of delay. Well, he did not. He did not believe him, and he got into his friend got into trouble. He went into a battle, and there was a great loss. Fabius heard about this, and he was irritated. He said, "Well, I've got to get back to the war, and I've got to punish this guy." Well, this guy, who was his master of the horse, had some political connections in Rome, and so his relative in Rome talked to the people, talked to the Senate about this, and they were worried that now this person who acted courageously at war, this master of the horse, and got into this messy battle, was going to be punished, maybe even killed by Fabius Maximus. And so what they did was they elected that guy, the master of the horse, the sidekick, as co-dictator, which was never been done before. But, you know, the idea was that it would restrain our current dictator from misbehaving, and he couldn't kill his co-dictator. So Fabius goes back and back to war, and he has a co-dictator now, and he's got this problem he's got to deal with. This master of the horse, let's see, well, I wanted to read this to you about it. It says, "When Minucius put on haughty airs and boasted of the fact that the dignity of the highest and most powerful office in the state had been humbled and its authority reduced on his account, Fabius quietly reminded him that his real opponent, that is, the master of the horse's real opponent, if he stopped to consider the matter, was not Fabius, but Hannibal." You know, what a wise guy, you know, what a wise and thoughtful person, just very, very calm. So what he did was he decided, okay, we'll not do every other month like what the consuls did in terms of rule. We'll just divide the forces. And so the 1st and the 4th Legion went to the master of the horse, Fabius Maximus took the 2nd and 3rd Legions and controlled them. Well, almost immediately, the master of the horse guy, who is now the co-dictator, says, "Well, I've got this planned, and I know what I'm going to do." Hannibal set up a trap. He there was a place that had a great, there was a great hill, and in the valley was a, where there was a place with lots and lots of ruts and ditches and all that kind of stuff. And so Hannibal sent a bunch of men into the valley to hide in the ditches. And he in a big open show, he went up to the top of this hill, said, "Look, I've got the hill," started waving his flag. And of course, the master of the horse, who's this, you know, haughty guy, says, "Well, darn it, I don't want you to have the hill." And so he sends in his first and fourth legions to attack. And Hannibal springs the trap. He tells the people now who are in the rear, this army that's in the ditches, who is in the rear, to come up out of the ditches and attack the master of the horse's army from the rear, and routs them. And the cavalry comes in and starts cutting down all the Roman soldiers who are all fleeing. And of course, Fabius was watching this all from the side. He says, "There he goes. I knew he was going to do this." And so Fabius comes to the rescue, right? And he saves his buddy, his co-dictator, from the problem. And it was funny because Hannibal's watching this, and you know, he has to retreat. Hannibal ultimately has to retreat. And then Hannibal says jokingly to his friends, he says, "Haven't I kept telling you that the cloud we have seen hovering over the mountaintops would burst one day like a tornado?" And so he's talking about Fabius Maximus, who's just constantly up there in the hills waiting to jump him, you know. And he said, "I knew this guy would hit me one day." And here he comes and hits him. Now, so now this is a wonderful thing too. Let's see here. Now, so his master of the horse has been humiliated. He hasn't been killed. But he is a noble man. And so what he says is this: "Fellow soldiers, it is beyond the powers of mortal men to be placed in command of great enterprises and never to make a mistake. But it is the mark of courage and good sense to be able to profit from one's errors and treat a reverse as a lesson for the future. Let me confess then that although I have some slight excuse for blaming fortune, I have far more reason to praise her. In the short space of a single day, I have been taught what it has taken me all my life to learn. I can now see that I am not capable of commanding others, but need a commander myself, and that for all these years I have been cherishing the ambition to rise above men who I ought to have felt honored to acknowledge as my superiors. Now, in all other matters, the dictator, that is Fabius Maximus, shall be your leader. But in expressing our thanks to him, I shall take the lead and set the example by showing I am ready to follow his advice and obey his orders." And then he finally goes on to say, he's addressing now Fabius Maximus, who he's gone to basically, and you know, prostrates himself. And he addresses him as father. He says, "Dictator, on this day we have won two. You have won two victories, one over Hannibal through your bravery, and the other over your colleague through your generalship and your generosity. With the first, you saved our lives. With the second, you taught us a lesson. And just as Hannibal's superiority disgraced us, so yours has given us back not only our safety, but our honor. I call you by the name Father because it's the most honorable that I can use. And even a father's kindness is not so great as the kindness I have received from you. My father gave me life, but you have saved not only this, but the lives of all the men under me." And he ended by embracing Fabius and kissing him, and the soldiers on both sides followed his example, so that the whole camp was filled with rejoicing and tears of happiness. What a great man. I mean, even the master of the horse was a man who could learn. How much can we learn from this? Okay. So Fabius then, his dictatorship was over, and so he goes back to Rome, and they appoint another guy to be who is elected consul, and this guy's name is Varro, V-A-R-R-O. This is the name of computers. I think there's a Varro brand of computers. I don't think there's any relation necessarily, but that's a fact. Anyway, so Varro gets the ideas. Well, I want to change this tactic of the delayer, and he assembled 85,000 troops to attack Hannibal. And he approaches Hannibal, and Hannibal is really significantly undermanned compared to this. I mean, it has less than half the men. But Hannibal's a cool dude, right? So he's sitting up there, he's looking at this 85,000 men massed against his some significantly smaller number. And he says to his second in command, he said, you know, they're both looking at this thing together, and his sidekick Gisco says, "Ooh, man, that's a big army." And then Hannibal says, "There is another thing you have not noticed, Gisco, which is even more amazing." And when Gisco asked what it was, Hannibal replied, "The fact that in all this enormous host opposite, there isn't a single man named Gisco." And of course, everybody breaks into laughter, you know, because here's Hannibal saying, you know, "Give a joke." And so everybody in the army sees them all laughing. And so the entire host of Carthaginians are seeing their, you know, their leader, Hannibal, laugh at the fact that there are 85,000 people massed against him. And, you know, this attitude of the minor force changes the outcome. And 50,000 Romans are killed in this battle, and Hannibal wins. In this war, every family in Rome suffered the loss of a person, at least one person in their family. Huge impact, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, even down 200 years later, they're still fussing about Hannibal and worrying about Hannibal. So that's a crisis. I mean, that's even a bigger crisis than the initial loss when there were 15,000 people that were killed upon the initial invasion. So what happens is that Fabius then, you know, he's calm. He's collected. He takes steps to calm everybody down. He's not in office. Of course, he's a statesman, right? He's not one of the people that's in office, but he is a statesman. And here's what it says about Maximus Fabius in the parallel line. "Fabius was the only man to walk the streets with a resolute step, a serene expression, and a kindly voice. It was he who checked all womanish lamentations and prevented those who wished to bewail their sorrows from assembling in public. On the other hand, he persuaded the Senate to continue to hold its meetings, stiffened the resolutions of the magistrates, and made himself the strength and moving spirit of all the offices of state, since every man looked to him for guidance. He placed guards at the gates of Rome to prevent the frightened crowds from abandoning the city." At this point, everybody thought, well, now that Hannibal's had this great victory, he's just going to come to Rome and kill us all. "And he regulated the times and places which it was permissible to lament the dead. Those who wished to go into mourning were ordered to do so in their homes for a period of 30 days, at the end of which all mourning was to cease and the city was to be purified of such rites." So he was a great, great calmer in times of difficulty. Now the final story I want to tell you about Fabius Maximus is this. There was a town called Tarentum that had been lost. And there was an opportunity to get it back. And it's interesting because in this essay about Fabius Maximus, they tell the story of a couple love stories. And there is a love story in this one. A sister of a Roman soldier is having an affair with a person in the army there. And so Fabius encourages the brother to sneak in to visit his sister, pretend to defect, and then, you know, sort of get information. And because of all this intrigue and love affairs, Fabius Maximus ends up by taking this city, which had been lost to the Carthaginians some time previously. Now, the interesting thing about the story, it is an interesting story, just what I said, but the interesting thing from the standpoint of Plutarch is that Plutarch says that after Fabius Maximus takes the city, that he massacres some people. And he says this, Plutarch is saying this, probably true, but he's trying to be balanced. He's being fair and balanced in his description of Fabius Maximus by saying, you know, he wasn't perfect. He didn't always do the right thing. But, you know, he was a great person. So the final story is the end of this Punic War. Fabius Maximus continued his policy of delay up to the very moment of his death. Scipio Africanus, who was a great Roman general, said, "Look, after we've been at war here now for 17 years, 16 years, you know, let's go to his house and start messing with him." So Scipio wants to take the war to Africa. He wants to go to Carthage and attack them, hoping that it'll draw Hannibal out of Italy. And And Fabius Maximus says, no, it's much too dangerous. Don't do that. And so on his dying bed, he's opposing this. Well, when he dies, Scipio is sailing to Africa to implement this thing. And it's, in fact, Scipio is successful. He does draw Hannibal back. Hannibal is defeated in 2002, which is 1 year after the death of Fabius Maximus. And Fabius Maximus still, though, is revered as the father of his country and to great, 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 great praise. Now, that's the second thing I want to do. The final thing I want to do is much shorter, but this is the kicker, and this is why this is so interesting to me, this story, other than what it tells us about how we should interact with others, perhaps not attacking, but just being, you know, laying back, waiting for the moment. And here's the connection. Who has heard of the Fabian Society? We got a few people that heard of the Fabian Society. The Fabian Society was a British socialist organization, and it was founded on January the 4th, 1884. 1884, so 130 years ago, say. Now, what they wanted to do was to advance the principles of socialism using the principles of gradualism and reformism and not be revolutionary. They took their name from Fabius Maximus. The Fabians, the Fabian Society, a very famous society in Britain and America, took its name from Fabius Maximus because they, in the 19th century and the early 20th century, studied the parallel lives, which we did not until today or in last month. So, you know, this is crucial. The Fabian Society is a major foundation for the Labour Party. The Fabian Society was essentially a think tank. They had a vanguard called the Coefficients Club, which I think is funny. The Coefficients Club. Science. They must be scientific or mathematical types. And they were an offshoot of the Fellowship of Reason. No, I'm not saying that. They were an offshoot of the Fellowship of New Life. I don't know what they did, but... this is the statement in their opening brochure. It said, "For the right moment, you must wait, as Fabius did most patiently when warring against Hannibal, though many censured his delays. But when the time comes, you must strike hard, as Fabius did, or your waiting will be in vain and fruitless." Some of the famous people in the Fabian Society were George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, Virginia Woolf, Bertrand Russell for a while. The Fabian Society advocated the minimum wage, national public education, the breeding of an even a moderately imperial race, and so they were eugenicists. They wanted classical liberalism out, and they supported the Boer War because they were sort of nationalists. This was the Dutch War in Africa. Nehru was the Indian guy, the leader of India, was a Fabian. The founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was a Fabian. The Fabians favored free medical treatment, free dental, free spectacles. They supported generous unemployment benefits. Tony Blair was a Fabian. In 2004, the Fabian Society had 5,810 members. Have we ever heard of those programs? Did they win or did they not? They won. Day one. So, what we've learned today in three parts is we've learned some of the mythological history of Rome, and we've learned some of the actual history of the Roman Republic. We have gone over Plutarch's essay pretty thoroughly on the life of Fabius Maximus, and we have learned a vital connection to our American life today and the life of the West. We can learn from this, people. And I thank you for participating in this learning process. In 20 minutes, we will start the big show. Thank you very much.
Very good. So I have a couple comments. In the South, in the Confederate War, it's been similar to Joe Johnston. Was a Confederate general who was delaying the federal troops in their march down from Chattanooga to Atlanta. He knew he couldn't win because he was outgunned. It was a little bit different from the Punic situation here. but he was a cautious and prudent general. He wanted to delay the capture of Atlanta until after the presidential election, which it was thought that Abraham Lincoln would lose unless he had Atlanta in his grasp. And much like with Fabius Maximus, the leaders of the Confederacy got fed up with this timid approach and replaced Joe Johnston with a hot-blooded guy, Hood, who went out and got cut to ribbons by the federal troops. So it's just, and Sherman came through and annihilated everything, and Lincoln won the election and everything. So that was maybe another parallel life. Another thing I wanted to point out was this battle in which 50,000 Roman troops got cut to ribbons was at Cannae. And in 1991, after whatever it was, Operation Desert Storm, final battle, I was watching TV and Norman Schwarzkopf was on, and he was saying, "This is a classic tank battle. It is a Cannae." So the move, every military person that attends West Point, you know, is going to learn about the Cannae, which is a strategic move that Hannibal pulled to deceive the center of the force and then to come around flanks and circle the opposing force. And then the final point I wanted to make was I just read Frankenstein, and the monster in Frankenstein becomes this eloquent, knowledgeable being, and he does so by reading three books, one of which is Plutarch's Parallel Lives.
Yes!
Thank you very much, Sharon. Smallpox. It's the same thing, the late act. That was the way that Virginia all the way through was found an easy area. The way they held it was kind of from smallpox, taking the little dragon out of the red coats. The same trick. Muhammad Ali, that's why that's broken up. Same trick.
We can learn from this. All right. Any other comments before we start getting ready for form? All right. Thank you all for coming.